Greetings and salutations, everyone. I am AC2GS. My name is Roy, and I am net control operator for this, the Limark Technical Net. Limark Technical Net has been going strong for over 44 years, and every Sunday night around 8 p.m., we come together in front of our radios to chat with each other, to inform each other, to learn from each other, and hopefully entertain each other. And I thank you for joining me this Sunday night once again to try and do that. Let me drop for a second, and I will return with the usual links. Okay, if you want to reach me via email, my email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com, and that would be for mailbag questions, for TechNet puzzles, for sharing your technical expertise with some technology that's suddenly arrived in the news that we don't know that much about and you'd like to share it with us, and also for me to tap Paul on the shoulder and have him take a look for you for some space or NASA-related story. Of course, you can directly contact him. His email address is spacenetreport@gmail.com. Also, every week I cut and paste a bunch of interesting articles and or YouTubes and what have you onto a link page, and you can get to it anytime, 24/7. I leave it up for a long, long time. So if you're ever kind of suffering from insomnia and want to take a look at some interesting articles, at least articles I thought were interesting, just type into your browser roy.ac2gs.com, and that'll bring you to the link page. We have a chat room available. A lot of times it's quiet. Sometimes it's very, very noisy. You can get to it by typing into your browser chat.ac2gs.com. I offer an audio stream on the Internet of the TechNet, and I leave it on the rest of the week so you can listen in to Glen Oaks. And if you don't have a handy talkie around and you're not in radio distance, but you have an Internet connection, just type into your browser technet.ac2gs.com, and that'll give you the audio stream. Also, always like to remind people that Mike, KC2NJI, has a great archive site. It's called amateurradio.tv. And it has over a million visitors by now. It has archives of the Limark Technical Net that go as far back as September of 2006. So, you know, avail yourself of the wisdom of some amateur radio operators. Unfortunately, some of them have become silent keys, others have moved out of the area, but their wisdom persists in audio files on Mike's site, so keep that in mind. Let me drop for a second, and I'll tell you what we got planned for tonight. Okay. Regular vanilla edition of the Technical Net. We won't be having any guests of April. Preferably, the first few should be amateur radio related, but we're open to discuss any aspect of science and technology. People will hit the push to talk, tell me their call sign, their first name, and whether it's amateur radio related or technologically related. And we will make a list, and we will try to keep to the list. We can play around a little bit with it. Some people have very quick questions, and they don't have a lot of time on their hands. So we sometimes ask permission to move them up the list. But nevertheless, that's the first segment of our Technical Net. That hopefully should take us approximately to 10:15. Paul, WS2N, will then join us for the SpaceNet report. That should take us to approximately 11 p.m., and I will return to tie a bow on everything and wish you well for the coming week. That's the plan for tonight. So I wish us all good luck in this endeavor. We're open for business. If anyone has any questions or comments for tonight, please hit the push to talk and sign them.
BZ, Ham Radio.
Rich and Wesley recognized. Anyone else want to sign in for a spot on tonight's Technical Net? Please hit that push to talk. Okay, perhaps later on there'll be other people, you know, sometimes people come late. Sometimes people don't remember the question that they had on their mind until later on. So we will see how the night progresses. But hopefully we will have more participants out there with more questions or more topics for discussion. Rich, you're on first.
Okay. Good evening, Roy. Good evening, everybody. My first question is about batteries. First of all, can you charge a lithium ion battery with a regular 12-volt charger, Roy?
It's preferable to get a charger that is spec'd for lithium ion charging. It's not the same exactly as a generic lead acid battery. So you have to look in the specifications. There are chargers that are capable of flipping and using both types of medium, but unless it's documented in the instructions, I would not do it. There are subtle differences in the design of chargers for the two technologies.
Okay, second battery question. Why is lithium ion better than lead acid?
Well, it sort of depends on what your factors are. Lithium ion has a much higher energy density, so you can store more power in a lighter, smaller, case. And under some circumstances, their ability to take recharges, especially in iron, lithium ion, iron sulfate, they allow for a lot more discharge, recharge cycles than lead acid does. And also, their voltage drops less precipitously. With lead acid batteries, it starts up high, and as you discharge it, it's almost like a 45-degree angle sometimes of the declining voltage potential as a function of capacity. Lithium ion and lithium iron sulfates tend to be flatter for a longer range, and it's only towards the end of their charge that they drop voltage potential significantly. So there's a bunch of factors. Lead acid is cheaper, though, than lithium batteries. So if you just look into buy the least expensive for a given power capacity, lead acid is pretty much the king.
I just bought a new radio, a Zygu G90. It's a 20-watt HF radio, and no, not 6 meters, 20-watt HF radio, and I'm wondering how big a battery for portable use do you think I should get? I guess it's the difference is only in amp hours, right?
Yeah, that's the important thing, amp hours. Now, someone wanted to make a comment out there, so let's give him a little time. What's your comment, sir? I didn't catch an ID.
Good evening, KD2VHD, Jim. On a battery question for radio use, one big factor is that most of the radios will put out their designed power output at 13.8 volts that they usually get in the car. And at the 12 volts that a lead-acid battery usually operates at, they'll be at reduced capacity. Most of the lithium technology batteries put out closer to the 13.8 or so. So you'll get closer to your rated output of your radio. So for ham radio equipment, the lithium technologies have that edge.
Okay. I mean, I think most manufacturers of portable ham equipment take that into account and design devices that have a little bit of a playroom, before they start to act out. A lot of portable stuff that's meant to be plugged into cars can probably, on a good day, survive, 10.5 volts before they act very flaky, because All of these things started out being powered by automobile batteries. So I think they take that into account. But, yeah, it's nice the fact that, and even lithium iron sulfate, I think, has a slightly higher voltage potential for the given number of cells.
Roy, how many ampere hours of a battery would you suggest would be the minimum to run a portable HF rig?
It really depends upon how many hours and under what kind of circumstances you're going to run things. If you're going to run things full duty cycle, you're going to need more power. If you're going to use them for longer hours, you're going to need more power. There are some guys who just kind of take a 10 amp hour battery and when it runs out, it runs out. Other people invest a little bit more in something like a 30 amp hour battery. Very few people, I think, purchase 50 amp hour batteries because it starts to get somewhat more expensive at that point. And I think they sell even larger ones. So, again, it depends upon how long you want it to work. You can kind of figuring out the power output when you're transmitting and the power usage when you're receiving, and come up with a little average, and then add a good 20% cushion just in case. So it's up to you, but I mean I think that legitimately a 30 amp hour could give you a couple hours of fun. If anyone out there has more practical experience with portable use of batteries, please share your expertise.
VHD
again? I think that's a pretty hefty battery, isn't it? A 30 ampere battery?
Yeah, I would imagine it's about the 6-pounder. Jim, you wanted to say something?
Consider that when you use you wouldn't buy a cordless drill these days if you couldn't exchange a full battery for one that's charging and then go on about your business. You could get a 20 amp hour battery, but if you get two 10s, one could be charging the one you're using and have a smaller form factor. That's one consideration. The other consideration is the Zygu is fairly unique, or close to unique, in that it's a 20 watt output portable radio, which is pretty cool, but to utilize that capacity, you're going to use more power if you utilize it, so keep that in mind. I would consider, most importantly though, having two of whatever batteries so you can swap them out from my perspective. Thanks for letting me share. Back to that.
Okay, very good, Jim. I think, though, in Rich's case, he's planning to operate portable, so I don't think he's going to be going around with a solar panel. So I think he's thinking more of, charging it up at the base station and using it elsewhere. If you were kind of close to a power source, that would be a very good idea to have backup and have one charging while you're using the other. I think if you're going out to the park or a hill or something, it kind of is moot because there's no local opportunity to recharge the other battery.
That's true. I won't be able to recharge a battery in the field. So I'll take a look at them because I have two lead acid batteries. I wired them in parallel. Now let me ask this question. When you wire two batteries in parallel, the voltage stays the same, but the amps increase. Is that correct?
Yes, but you got to be careful and not do that with lithium ion. Lithium ion requires specific circuitry to load balance.
Okay. Well, I can't get either one of these batteries to charge and give a reading of more than 10 volts. Why would that be?
My guess is because they're shot. They probably are sulfonated. So they're on their last legs, and you're not being able to charge them anything close to 100% charge capacity. They're probably they probably run out of juice a lot faster than they used to as well. They're probably less than 50% charging.
Yeah, these are the Zygu works for about 30 seconds and then just starts making all kinds of noises because it's not seeing the 12 volts it wants to see. But these batteries haven't been used that much, and I just bought them last year, so I'm a little bit, you know, confused about how they could have gone out so quickly. They've been sitting outside the whole winter. I don't know if that could have, you know, affected them in any way, but I'm going to get a lithium ion battery anyway, and unfortunately, as you said, I need to buy a new charger in addition for the lithium ion. But as I said, they're wired in parallel. The volt, I know the volt, the, as opposed to series, the voltage stays the same whether they're wired in parallel or they're not wired together at all. But the amp hours are combined correctly to give you, if one battery has 10 amp hours and the other has 10 amp hours, you get 20 amp hours out of them now wired in parallel. Is that true?
Theoretically, if they were working properly and getting 100% recharge, rechargeable batteries have no particular guarantee that you could recharge them back to 100%. And there are ways of preserving their ability to recharge and their level to recharge, and there are ways to screw it up. Exposing it to excess heat will accelerate decrease the life expectancy of your battery. So if it was a brand-new battery, if both of them were brand-new, then both of them would have 10 amp hours capacity, and putting them in parallel would give you approximately 20 amp hours. The capacity is a kind of marketing problem. Capacity is very dependent upon how much the rate that you're drawing energy. That 10 amp hour is rated if you bleed the battery over a couple of months. You know, the longer it takes for you to tap the energy, the more energy you could get from the battery. You try and tap your battery's total power in about an hour and a half, you'll probably destroy the battery, but you'll also not be able to extract more than half of that amp hour rating. So it's a little bit of a marketing ploy. But theoretically, you connect them parallel, they give you twice as much capacity. But because your batteries are dying, and it's not only use but age, you know, batteries aren't immortal if you leave them on the shelf, especially lead acid, so they'll age. So depending upon how they were exposed, it probably wasn't a great idea to leave them out in the open. They get cold, they get hot. It accelerates the aging process. There's that.
Okay. All right. So those are the battery questions. Now, second, and the audience, I think, might find this interesting. You and I have been going back and forth all week on the 25-foot adjustable whip that I bought for portable use. I also bought a tripod with it, and that's how it's mounted. I have a choke mounted right near the feed point, but I got confused about quarter wave versus half wave use of this 25 foot whip. And now I have it sorted out, but let me just ask you the broad overall question. What is the advantage, besides needing radios for the quarter wave and besides needing an on for the half wave use of it, what are the advantages, if any, assuming the right amount of enough radios and enough what's the advantage, if any, of the half wave over the quarter wave?
Okay, everything is sort of a compromise. Quarter wave is a very good mono band antenna. It's small, it's efficient, with the right components, and it's relatively simple. A NFED half wave is a multi-band antenna. You can kind of string one side of it, it requires far less attachments than, say, a centiped dipole. It's resonant on multiple bands, but it's inefficient because you have to utilize a significant impedance transforming balun, which introduces a degree of loss. And it's not as omnidirectional as a quarter wave vertical. So I mean, there's probably loads and loads of other little nitpicky kind of details between the two models. They both have their place. If you're interested in a single frequency and you want something simple that has less failure points and more efficiency, then a quarter wave ground plane is a good design.
But I actually get more bands. I finally made a table of band and the length of of width that I need, and I get more bands as a quarter wave vertical than I do as an NFED. For instance, on 10 meters at the top, the width only has to be 8.5 feet high for a quarter wave wave vertical. Then on 12, it's 9.9 feet, 15, it's 11.7 feet, 17, it's 13.6 feet, and 20, it's 17.6 feet. If I want to go up to, on 30, it's 24.4 feet. So it goes all the way down to 30 meters at 24.4 feet. Of course, 40 meters it won't do without a coil. But let me let it drop a second. For a half-wave antenna, it's 8.5 feet. Hold on a second. It's 17.6 feet at 10 meters, 19.8 feet at 12, 23.4 feet at 7, and 23.4 feet at 15 on 15 meters, and on 17 meters, it's 27.2 feet. So two feet, 2 inches longer than I have a width for. So I'm actually getting two more bands with the quarter wave than I am with the NFED, Roy?
Yeah, when I was talking about a quarter wave ground plane, I was talking about an uncomplicated standard build that you could put on a roof or any place. You could put it on the other side of your lawn. You're changing the dimensions of your antenna. Once you're able to magically change the dimensions of your antenna, it becomes functionally multi-band based on just the adjustability of your antenna. But if you were kind of using that without changing it, it would be a monoband antenna. Whereas you can operate an NFED without making any structural changes, and you can still have it work on multiples of the amateur radio band.
You see, you aren't taking into consideration the adjustability of the whip. Okay, well, that all makes sense now. I wonder if I could, with the antenna in the G90, the Zygu G90, the antenna tuner, is supposed to be legendary, that it'll tune anything. It'll tune a coat hanger. Of course, you know, how much stuff you're putting at what angle in the air is a big question. So on the, for an NFET with the whip fully extended at 25 feet, on 17 meters, it has to be actually 27.2 feet. So I need a little extra whip than I have to get on 17. But I think for only 2.2 feet, I might be able to get away with it. But now it's true for an NFET half wave, you could get away with one, maybe two counterpoises, right?
Yeah, NFET half waves are not as sensitive to counterpoises. They'll take whatever your setup gives it and try and do the best. But I mean, yeah, there are some reports that you know people have put a not put a ground wire anywhere near it, and let the common mode act as a counterpoise and put an RF choke a couple of inches away from their balance and still got away with a decent antenna. So it's a lot less important for the NFET of thinking in terms of a counterpoise.
Yes, and which is better if you could use the term better? The choke at the feed point of the antenna, does it make any difference if you put it at the transceiver end of the system?
Again, it depends on really what you want to do. If you need some common mode operation to act as a counterpoise, it's not a good idea to put the RF choke right at the other balance point, because you might have some problems operationally. So you should have some length between the 49 or 56 or 64 to 1 balance and the RF choke. It doesn't have to be all the way to your shack. It could be halfway to your shack. It could be a third of the way. It's something that's open to experimentation. You would want to at least choke it a yard or two before it gets near your shack so that it lessens it acting as an antenna locally and radiating RF into your computer and other equipment in your shack.
Some people use both, right? They have a choke at the feed point and a choke at the radio.
Hopefully not for people who are doing NFEDs and they don't have a balun connection for ground. Because you need a little bit of counterpoise for a half-wave NFED. There are people out there who put multiple RF chokes on their regular antennas, verticals or, you know, horizontals or any kind. As I mentioned before, common mode chokes are not binaries. It's not a one or a zero. It's a how many decibels of attenuation you get with your given RF choke. And if you put a second RF choke, you get even more attenuation. So there are people who choke at the antenna feed of a dipole, and sometimes they put another one at the entrance to their shack. Doesn't cause any particular problems having too much RF choking for those circumstances. You just have to understand whether you need the use of common mode currents or not. Most cases you don't. In the unusual case of an NFED half wave, you do to a degree.
And if you put the choke in before the on, it'll choke off the counterpoise, right?
No, it won't. No, because it'll choke off the counterpoise. No, it depends on what you're using for the counterpoise. If you're using a ground connection, it wouldn't have any effect. It wouldn't serve any particular purpose. You really want to do the RF choking on the on the transmission line. And after the ballot has had it's done its job, there's no real need to. If you introduce RF chokes before the ballon, I don't know, it might interact with the antenna too much because it's a local inductor. So I think it would be best to put it at the other side of the impedance transforming ballon or run-on.
Yeah, I understand that. Well, if you're using the coax shield as the counterpoise, and it gets rid of common mode, it may do wonky things to the design of the antenna. My last question is, if I could remember it, coils. Can you use a coil with a half wave like you would use a coil with a quarter wave?
Well, the short answer is yes. The long answer is, as I've mentioned to you in the past, there's a little bit of a problem with purely N-fed half-wave antennas. By themselves, the harmonics for those antennas drift a little bit away from the ham band. So if you just have a one-half wavelength piece of wire, you put it to a 49-to-1 ballon, you put that to a choke, it will work fine for that half a wavelength. But for the harmonics, you'll notice on a DNA sweep that the peak resonances kind of shift a little bit off where you want them to be. So the means of correcting that is most designs for NFEDs also have either a capacitor or much more frequently a small inductive coil to correct for that drift. So the design of most NFED half waves have a coil already. Now, if you increase the inductance for the coil, you effectively are lengthening the electrical wavelength of the antenna. So if it's a large enough coil, it operates electrically as though it's a half wave for a much lower frequency, which is what you're looking for. So you're looking to change the electrical characteristics of your NFED with a coil in series with it, such that it, instead of being resonant at 20 meters, it's now resonant at 40 meters. So you know, people do that. You have to pay for that. It increases the Q, decreases the bandwidth, increases the inefficiencies because loading coils introduce insertion losses and you know things like that. But it's doable.
Would you say a coil works better with a quarter wave antenna?
In terms of what? If you want to turn a quarter wave for 20 into a quarter wave for 40?
QSL, as we say.
Okay. Fundamentally, you have the same problem. Every time you introduce a loading coil, it's a compromise because we talked about this many times. Otherwise, everyone would just buy a ham stick and stick it on their roof and be done with it. If you introduce a shortened antenna physically and then electrically lengthen it with a compensating loading coil, you increase the Q, decrease the bandwidth, decrease the radiation resistance, and increase the inefficiency.
Yeah. No matter whether you're using it as a half wave or a quarter wave, I guess. Is that correct?
Yeah, there are different ways of modifying antennas to be electrically resonant at lower frequencies. A far more difficult one, but more fulfilling, is by putting a capacitive hat on the antenna. If you put a capacitive hat on the antenna, you usually put it on the end of the antenna so you don't have the high current, which you do with a loading coil. and also it keeps the radiation resistance high, which makes the antenna more efficient. So if you had to do something to change the resonance of an antenna for a lower frequency, as functionality, the best way is to put a capacitive hat on it. Mechanically, it's a pain in the backside, which is why almost no one does that, because it's mechanically less stable than a loading coil at the base.
Yeah, and on a whip, not only is the top very thin, but you can't do it. There's no way to attach a capacitive hat to a whip at the top. No way that I know of. Somebody probably has done it. But us mortals can't figure out how. And that's my last question. How do capacitive hats work?
They add capacitance in such a way that they retune the antennas. Are tuned circuits. They basically have virtual capacitors and inductors, and based upon the inherent capacitance and inductance, and also unfortunately resistance, that determines the resonance of the antenna. When it's in resonance, the capacitive and inductance cancel out, and all that's left is hopefully radiation resistance, which causes the RF current to turn into electromagnetic waves in the air, and out they go. So hopefully that explains it.
What'd you say, hopefully what?
I said, hopefully that explains how they work. It's adding edge capacitance on a tuned circuit, which we call an antenna. And the qualities, like I said, because of the location, it's not in a place that's a high current point, so you're not going to have the insertion losses that you do when you put an inductive coil at the base where the current is highest. And because of the nature of the capacitance that's added, you're not affecting the radiation resistance, which the inductor diminishes.
Yeah. Well, no, that does explain it, Roy. It explains it very well, explains it very clearly. Why did they put a capacitor in a 49-to-1 on? Why did they put a capacitor on the shield side?
Well, it's not that they put it on the shield side. It's that basically they short out the transformer using the capacitor, because, again, you're dealing with tuned circuit, and the balun will have a non-linear relationship to frequency. If you just do the toroid and the windings and you hook it up to, say, something like an SWR, you will see the attenuation loss climbing usually as you go higher and higher in frequency, which is kind of okay if you're just a monoband type of a thing. But again, this is a multi-band thing. So for those 49 or 56 or 64, the ones you need a capacitor to balance out the inductance for the tuning circuit, so that the response of the balun will have the same loss across the frequencies that you're going to use. I think you even showed me a YouTube where the guy kind of plays with different capacitors or no capacitors, and you could see in his VNA sweep the dramatic change of the loss in that balun or anon. I forget which it was, but that's the reason why you want a nice uniform, relatively efficient anon. Without the capacitor, it will be uneven, and at high frequencies like 10 meters, it will be terrible.
Yeah, there's even a difference between capacitors. Apparently, the manufacturer TDK makes the best capacitors, and they work much better than, you know, the generic from eBay capacitors. Well, that's about it for me, Roy. Thank you very much. Cleared up a lot. And the next phase is to actually get this radio into my car at some park and see if I can make any QSOs. I've already, with the whip fully extended, I've already talked to Portugal, England, and the Virgin Islands. So something's working okay. That Zygo radio is really a fun little radio. I can't wait to get it out of in the field and get me out in the field also, instead of sitting around operating from the house all the time. All right, Roy, thanks, 73. I'll be listening.
AC2GS. Well, thanks. Thank you, Rich, and I wish you luck with it. And I'm sure you're going to get many, many, many hours of fun out of the thing. And you kind of bought it at the right time, because any day now we're going to get the tariff bumps, and it's going to be a lot more difficult to get things, and the prices will be a little strange. So. We'll see how that all goes, but I wish you the best of luck, and I look forward to future questions.
I will try to scientifically write down exactly how things go. So, thanks a lot, Roy. W2BZ.
You're welcome, Rich. Once again, this is AC2GS. Let me see if anyone came late to the show and has any questions or comments for tonight. If you want to get on the list, it's still open, so just hit that push to talk, give me your call sign, and whether you have a amateur radio question or non-amateur radio request question, give it a try.
DAW supporting.
Thank you. I appreciate. Anyone else out there who has a question for tonight, let me know.
AC2PL also supporting. Maybe one question.
Okay. Well, why don't we try your maybe question? Wes is still on the list. But usually Wes has a lot more questions to ask, and I'm sure it's okay with Wes if Jeff goes before you. Is it, Wes?
No problem.
Thank you very much. Okay, Jeff, it's yours.
All right, Roy, just a question popped in my head. I was taking a course out at Brookhaven last week, and some of the discussion turned to briefly to the Nyquist limit, and I wonder if you can put that into layman's terms, just to discuss what the limit is in a kind of practical sense with respect to, say, resolution.
Okay, Nyquist limit is has to do with resolution of signals when you digitize them. What's the fastest signal frequency you can capture with a given bit rate? And approximately, it's one half the bit rate. So if you're making 40,000 samples, you can resolve a 20 kilohertz cycle signal. Not anything much above it. Above it, you get distortion that you can't deal with very well. So, I mean, that's kind of the quickest, dirtiest answer to Nyquist limit. I hope that suffices, Jeff.
Absolutely does. And it's in the context of a detector readout. So It's going, they give the detector read out at a certain hertz, and the Nyquist limit is given as the resolution that's achievable based on that readout speed. So that makes absolute sense. Thank you very much, AECQPL. Back to that. Good night, Rick.
You're very welcome, Jeff. Thank you for participating. Anyone else out there who has any kind of questions that they'd like to get their name on the list?
AD2DU.
AD2VHD.
Oh, okay. Let's see. We got Alex, and we have Jim. Well, once again, I turn to Wesley. Do you mind if I take them first, Wesley?
No problem at all.
Okay, very good. Adam, what's your question for tonight? Alex, are you out there?
Yeah, does it matter if, like, do you want to be higher in elevation relative to other places, or do you just need a clear line of the horizon? Like, does being on top of a building matter versus being in Kansas 10 feet in the air? Because if you can see the horizon evenly, I don't know, does height matter in sea level sense? ADTDU.
Okay, it sort of depends, unfortunately. I hate to sound like Facebook. It depends. In some cases, elevation is incredibly useful. If you have a center-fed dipole, it's a good practice to have it at least a half of a wavelength off the ground, because there's ground reflections that will lead to a distortion of your radiation pattern and turn it into a much more of a near-vertical incident sky wave, as opposed to something that'll shoot off to the horizon and skip along the ionosphere. So for those antenna designs that are affected by ground conditions, you need to abide by those. For antennas that don't really have much coupling with the ground, if you don't have any obstructions, then it makes little difference if you elevate it or don't elevate it, because the only good rationalization is that you're elevating it to get the takeoff angle to be above the obstructions. If there are no obstructions, then the point is moot.
Makes sense. I think that answers my question. Thank you, Roy. Back to net, 82 to you.
You're welcome, Alex. Jim, what's your question tonight?
So I've read the phrase that digital modes can operate below the noise floor. And I can't quite get the concept, but is that true? Is it not true? Is it true of some modes? Can you shed some light on that concept of digital modes or sub-digital modes being able to operate below the noise floor level?
Okay. Sometimes people will waive this for digital voice modes, fusion, DMR, D-Star. I don't buy it from experience. Different modes respond to four conditions differently. At some levels, digital voice modes have auto-correcting abilities and can survive, but you reach the inevitable point where they completely screw everything up. So I wouldn't exactly use that as a description for digital voice modes. It is a description for digital low-signal algorithms from Joe Taylor and his friend Frank, which gives you the FT8 protocols. In those cases, they are offering below-the-noise floor signal transfer. The way that they do it is not by any kind of magic, but by computer noise reduction, redundancy, and corrective data. So they treat it like a digital packet on the Internet, in that there are some ways that the digital packet can be screwed around with to a certain point, and it can still recover. So what that presents in the real world is that you can do FT8 with a signal that's below your noise floor because, again, of the redundancy and because of the error correction. Now, that introduces there's much bigger packet for the information, so the effective symbol rate is what you pay the goddess of physics in return. So, you know, just what I said right now, if you pushed it through FT8 or really JS8 call, would take a half hour. And no one would waste a half hour trying to hear me say this paragraph.
That's a very interesting perspective. So you pay in time what you would pay for in signal quality.
Yep, in the end, you always have to pay. Mother Nature doesn't take credit cards.
Very good perspective. That helps a lot. Thank you very much. Thanks. Back to Ned.
Okay, very good. Let's see if we can find one more guy. Because, you don't need an hour and a half, Wes, but we'll see. Anyone else with any questions or comments for tonight? If they want to get on the list, please hit that push to talk.
Okay, is this Bill coming?
Yes, Jeff.
Yeah, Roy, to follow up on your recent comments there, so the redundancy is really what does it, and, you know, you can do all the other tricks of digitization, but if you have redundancy, you can extract a lot of noise, a lot of signal out of the noise, as long as you're working with a narrow frequency, a narrow window of frequencies. We do a lot of digital processing for, you know, for example, from X-ray data or cryo-EM data, and things that look like actual noise, when you have a lot of redundancy, the signal comes up amazingly, and it requires that type of analysis to look for cross-correlation. When the correlation coefficient falls off to even something as low as, say, 0.14, I think theoretically that's where you can't extract any more reasonable information. But that's a very, very low correlation coefficient. And we never accepted data that was that low in the old days. We used residuals and R factors back then. But, in today's scientific data, the residuals go off the chart, while the correlation coefficients are actually still measurable. QSL?
Yeah, good to know. By the way, you know, they're still talking about the damn pyramids.
I love that. I really hope that doesn't go away. It's comedy.
Yeah, I don't know. It just seems that none of these things ever actually goes away. It's just new things kind of come up to go to the right and to the left. And it's like someone with a scrapbook that never throws any pages away. It's amazing.
Keep doing what you're doing, and eventually we'll succeed, I hope. AC2PL, thanks so much for what you do.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate the words. Always nice to hear kind words. I found out the other day that my call sign was on the cover of the E-Log this month, along with other people who do net controlling. So it's nice to be appreciated. So I thank you for that. Well, Wes, what do you got for us tonight?
Okay. Enter Exilion. A bunch of things. Let's start from ham radio related. So the first image that Dr. Roy was at, a Wi-Fi remote control to an antenna rotator. So in other words, is we don't need the antenna rotator Antenna rotator display with the needle. That was ALL-98. I believe that one had a circular display for the angle of the rotating antenna. So we don't need that any longer. And we could add Wi-Fi. And with that we could use tablet, computer, or your phone. And this is a very clever device. I mean, it's nothing special. Most of ham radio operators could make one on their breadboard. Not a big deal at all. So there was Yaesu G1000DXC, was the rotator with the display and now display we connect the WRC board, which is actually two relays, so left, right, and whatever the auxiliary one, and then it does have a front panel board which shows you the angle. Now, clever thing is that all of it is 2-inch by 2-inch first board, and the other one is probably 2-inch by 2-inch or 2-inch by 1.5-inch, which has the display on it and two buttons if you want to press those buttons left, right, and double switch control. So that's absolutely something that I love. And it is sold by, sold by America Foxtrot 6 Sierra Alpha, AF6SA. It is done good way, and I will be enjoying looking at that video. Maybe Dr. Roy has a comment on it. Back to you.
DKH2GS. It's another one of those ESP boards. We've talked about ESP chip boards before. They're primarily micro controllers as opposed to microprocessor units. But their big thing is they let you put in Wi-Fi and control the controller through Wi-Fi applications. I have a couple of things running on ESP Wi-Fi circuits here in the house. The way they presented it was a little different, though, Wes. They presented it not as a replacement for the controller, but as a augmenter to allow for wireless operation of the controller. So most of what I saw in the video had them tapping into the controller in order to get the Wi-Fi to work through a web browser interface, through a phone interface, and things like that. So, people have been tinkering with things like that. Rich, W2BZ, has a Wi-Fi controllable magnetic loop capacitor actuator that is very kind of similar in design somewhat. The servos are a little bit different for different purposes, but, nothing particularly amazing. I think it's not necessary to reinvent the wheel. If you have an ESP board and, you get the other add-on board with the relays and a little bit of soldering and you don't have to reinvent the wheel. But it's out there for people interested. I think most times people are just used to using their controller and 9 times out of 10 will just continue to use their controller. Some guys who are really into software can design interfaces so that when you change your radios into one mode or the other, and it's location biased, it'll automatically swing the rotator on command. But that depends on your level of introductory programming.
Okay. Well, I have a little different opinion. Maybe I received it differently. So. You have a very much unsophisticated, I'm not saying primitive, So let's say you have a 12 relays on the board. Ultronix makes them. So you have a 12 relays on the board. Ultronix sells also relays that you can actually break down, break out. So you have a 6 relays on the board and you could use each one separately if you want. The only electronics that is there is the Wi-Fi that is added to it. It's nothing more than that. Now, that's...